want to welcome you to the Trauma Informed Educators Network podcast. This podcast is coming out of the Trauma Informed Educators Network Facebook group. I am so looking forward to talking to people globally about their trauma informed journey. As the principal of Fall Hamilton Elementary School, a trauma informed school in Nashville, Tennessee, I have learned that this is not a destination, and it truly is a process of learning and adjusting. So this podcast will be speaking to guests all over the world about people who are just starting their journeys and people have been on this journey for many, many years. So I hope you enjoy our guests. I hope you learn something just as I am. And welcome to the Trauma Informed Educators Network podcast. All right, here is episode number 39 of the podcast. And today's guest is Lauren Spiegelmeyer. Over the past 10 years, she has helped so many people learn about the brain and how it impacts learning and well-being, which in turn changes behavior. With her master's degree in education and a background in coaching, she has thrived on building brain and research-based child-driven trainings and courses. Being an adventurer, she loves to find non-traditional solutions and make sure that boundaries are pushed. When not solving problems for parents, she travels the world to explore non-Western psychological approaches such as Indian yoga, Chinese Qigong, and African drumming. She has also traveled for food, fun, and the experiences. It's not all work. She creates and teaches brain biology courses at the University of Pennsylvania, which aligns to her current research in behavioral neuroendocrinology. This is a field that is fascinating. Aside from all the work stuff, she loves to study wine, explore stinky cheese, hike, read, grow her jungle of plant collection, ride a motorcycle, and hang out with her favorite humans. So, without any further time, this is what Lauren had to say. All right, we are live here on all kinds of platforms. We have Facebook and we're on LinkedIn and we're on YouTube and all kinds of great stuff. So thank you, Lauren, for being here. I'm so excited. You are my 39th guest on the podcast and just excited to have you. So tell us about you.
Cool. Would love to. And thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. Hey, all. I am Lauren Spiegelmeyer. I am the founder of the Behavior Hub. We are an organization based in Baltimore, also outside of Philadelphia and Lancaster City, and work with schools and with families to address youth mental behavioral health through a very holistic, whole body approach. I'm not doing that. You can find me at the University of Pennsylvania, course creating and teaching on their trauma platform. And I also do a lot of training for Department of Ed. So lots of things education, lots of things behavior, lots of things stress and trauma.
So, you know, we did talk for a few minutes before we went live, but I didn't give you all the questions that I was going to ask. And really, I didn't give you any. I just said, hey, let's talk about these things. How did you come about this journey of trauma-informed education? And I always ask that question because I'm always curious on the avenue in which you landed in this world of trauma-informed education.
Yeah, it's a great question and a question that leads me to ultimately the development of the Behavior Hub, the organization that I started. But I think it really started my first year of teaching. I graduated a year early, so I was 20 years old in the classroom teaching full time, ended up in a building that was removed from the rest of the school. So I don't know why the principal thought it was good to put us two first year teachers out in a modular building by ourselves, but we were there and had a very challenging class, had a lot of kids with emotional disturbance labels and being in the modular building with no water hookup, like electricity problems. It was quite the year. But in that year, with these really challenging kids, I became very curious about them because I had been forewarned they were going to be in my class or all these negative stigmas behind them and comments. And I thought, well, that's so unfair to place that on a child. It's a new year and they should have a new start. So ended up really getting to know these kids and then getting really curious about why they behaved the way that they did and went into a deep, deep rabbit hole of neurobiology and the nervous system and stress and trauma and ultimately realized that it connected to my own childhood quite a bit as a child who has a very high adult who has a very high ACEs score and has multiple levels of trauma and abuse. I'm like, wow, I think the reason that I was so curious about them was because I was actually curious about myself. I could resonate with them and what they were going through and being misunderstood by adults, by the systems, by people. and didn't want kids to feel that way. So started working to help kids and then started working to help adults understand these kids.
And you know, that's powerful because, you know, I've said on this podcast many, many times that this work is about the adults, right? The kids aren't broken. The systems in which we operate and the way we handle students who communicate through behavior is actually what's broken. So I love that you're jumping in with adults. And I also resonate with that piece of like, hey, I experienced some things and what resonates with me is seeing myself in kids. And I think it's interesting because so many people that I've spoken to have said the same thing. Right. You know, us little, what I refer to as our unapologetic disruptors, we were disrupting a long time ago. Some of us got in trouble a lot. And now we just have found this superpower of doing it for good. So awesome, awesome. So let's talk about some of the processes that you use when you're training adults. I know that you, you like so many of us, love that Dan Siegel model. So talk about what you do for adults and how you introduce the idea of trauma and the impacts of trauma.
Yeah, I like Dan Siegel's work. I really love Bruce Perry's work and Vander Kolk's work, all these well-known people in the field. But I mean, the reason they're so well-known is because their information has stood the test of time. But usually when I start, I go right into the science because I want people to understand the why behind all of this. And if I can help them understand the neuroscience and the human biology behind it, there's a little bit more buy-in and motivation for the strategy work. Because I can give them the strategy work, but they don't understand why we're using it. It's not very helpful and it doesn't create great buy-in and there's not motivation to use it. So typically I will introduce the emotional brain first. So Dan Siegel has the upstairs brain, downstairs brain, which I'm sure a lot have heard of, but Georgetown actually took that hand signal or that concept and really broke it down for young kids. And this is typically how I will explain it because it makes it so simple for young kids, for older kids, for parents, but they do this hand signal where they tuck the thumb, wrap the fingers around, and they call the downstairs brain the barking dog. So it barks when a child is triggered, when an adult is triggered, when anyone's triggered or stressed out or anxious, dog is barking. And then the fingers across the top are the thinking brain, prefrontal cortex. We call that the wise owl, and it flies. So what happens here, and what I usually explain, is that the barking dog gets activated by something in the classroom, in the environment, a teacher maybe gets activated, dog barks, and the loud barking of the dog scares away the wise owl. So when we reach a certain point of emotional elevation, we can't access logic and reason. And that's why when we are redirecting kids and trying to get them to do things or to stop doing things, once they've reached that certain like height of elevation emotionally, you can't reason with them. You can't talk to them. You can't put requests on them. You can't ask them to do stuff. They actually biologically can't understand you and respond.
And it's powerful because that's not just kids, right? That's humans, that's all of us, right? If we get to that point of dysregulation where we're in that limbic system of our brain of just completely not able to comprehend and reason, of course we're going to flip potentially, right? And I think it's powerful because this is, although many of us who have been using this work for so long, this idea is new to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, even for those of us who have done this for several years, there's still those moments where we're like, oh my goodness, I can feel it happening. I can feel the dysregulation. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about, when you're talking about dysregulation, you talk about different needs, right? And areas of needs for students that you work with, that you train around. What are those areas and how do you utilize those to shift the paradigms of adults?
Yeah, I think when challenging behaviors occur, when the dog is barking or what causes the dog to bark, I can typically categorize into five different needs areas. And sometimes the needs, there'll be more than one need area, but when I'm listening to and I'm kind of hotspot coaching parents and educators, I will start with listening to what the behaviors are and I will kind of file them away and categorize them into the different need areas so that I can base interventions on that. So the five needs areas are the need to self-regulate or emotionally regulate, the need to have control, the need for attachment, relationship building, a physical need, so food, water, sleep, And the last one is sensory need. So most times when I work with kiddos, there are multiple needs. I mean, most will check yes on self-regulation. A lot will check yes on control. And that makes sense. Right now, the world feels out of control. Things feel out of control. So we're trying really hard to grasp and regain control. But I will categorize the behaviors into those five need areas. So if a child is being defiant or oppositional, okay, that's maybe a need for control. Maybe also a need for self-regulation. If a child seems kind of slow and more mopey, and maybe that they're hungry or maybe they're tired. And when I can start to kind of play detective and put those behaviors into those categories, then what I do is I look at those categories and I start to put strategies in place that meet those needs. So if it's a control need, I try and find ways to give back control to the child. And then I start to see the behaviors diminish completely because the needs are met. When the needs are met, the behaviors go away.
You know, and one of our big strategies at our school is empowerment, right? It is giving kids a voice because, matter of fact, we teach the 7 habits of highly effective people, and a lot of people don't know habit 8, which is find your voice, which is the one that kids tend to resonate and connect to the most. Yeah. And I've learned that same thing, even if it's two options that you're okay with, as long as they get to choose, a lot of times it is a game changer for them, right? And that creates that safety. It creates that I get to choose. So where do these five need areas compete with the idea of behaviorism, right? Or we're talking about ABA, you know, to avoid a task, to seek approval or attention. How do you see those working? I don't want to say together because that's not what I mean, but how do you see the paradigm shifting from what so many schools hear about behaviors and how you're describing them?
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, when I'm working with parents and adults, teachers, anyone who works with kids, my big thing here is we get so frustrated with these behaviors and we tend to just react and respond to them. But can we control our emotional state well enough that we get curious about why the behaviors are happening? Because we can define it as avoidance or escaping or whatever, and that's great. But like, why are they avoiding? Why are they escaping? What's the deeper? Because having been in education as long as I have, I'm like, it's such a thing where we see the behavior, just want the behavior to stop, and we put something in place to get the behavior to stop. But it's just, I mean, if it's a deeper rooted issue that we're not getting to and we're not taking care of, it's just going to manifest itself in other ways. And you're going to see the behaviors display in different ways. So it takes a little bit more time, a little bit more digging, yes. But I think the difference here is really digging down into the root cause and making sure that root cause is being addressed and met. And then you'll stop seeing some of those behaviors. So I would say it's a deeper level than what we're going to with most behavior approaches.
So how did you come up with these five? How did you come about? Because I think the more I'm listening to them, I'm like, oh my gosh, these are brilliant. And because so many people want an idea of why, right?
Yeah.
Why is this happening? And we know a lot of it is trauma, but you nail every single area that a kid could potentially be dysregulated around. So where did they come from?
Great question. As is all of my work, it's from doing way too much reading, researching, listening to podcasts. And I take little bits and pieces from everybody and everything that I like, and I mash it together to fit what I want. So I know some of it came from Eric Jensen's work. He writes a lot on poverty in the brain and SES. And then the other part of it comes from, I think it's Peter Hall wrote a book, The 3 R's. I think it's regulation, relationship, and responsibility, if I recall correctly. Maybe not in that order, but if you search that and you search Peter Hall, you'll find the book. So I know that he talks about it a lot in there. I think he only goes into 3 or 4 needs areas. I added 1 or 2. I think sensory was one that I added because I noticed that it's one that really, I think, does seem to be on there, and it often can come from other areas and other diagnoses and things, but I felt like it was an important one to include to capture all of the areas where I could think that would cause behaviors. But I just a little bit of each of their work pulled together to make a framework that I liked.
I love it. I think it's amazing. Honestly, the more I was hearing you go down, I'm like, yes, 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 yes. So powerful. And sensory is such a key. And for educators who are listening, if you don't know your occupational therapist, you are missing an opportunity of brilliance, because the more I spent time with my OT, the more I learned, oh my goodness, like there's so many strategies that OTs and even speech. I mean, some of these amazingly gifted professionals in our schools are so underutilized, but sensory is such a major impactor to so many kids. And I want to give one quick example. And I know this, when I say sensory, this could mean a multiple things, but there's specifically one that a child experienced outside of school, something very severe, based off of gun violence, right? And every time he would hear anything of a loud noise, it would send him into a spiral of dysregulation. Mm-hmm. And it took us so long to figure out, because we weren't paying attention to it. And finally, he's like, every time I hear like somebody drops a chair, sends him into full on dysregulation. So it's even some of those tiny things when we're talking about sensory that can change so much for a kid in school.
Yeah. I think to piggyback on that story, like here's an example of a four-year-old who couldn't express something like that, was in a Head Start classroom where when they would transition to their like quiet nap time, they would flip the lights off. And that was the transition into nap. So every time they did that every day, this four-year-old just lost it. I mean, she would jump up on the windowsill, jump off, shove the bookshelves. She would push, she would scream, and she just lost control completely. And they couldn't figure out what was triggering her. And this is where we're so quick to respond, because they're trying to stop the behavior. They're trying to stop. And they're like, why is she doing this? Why is she? It's like, well, get curious. What might have caused this? Why do you think? So my thought is that is such a strong reaction. And to me, that's a red flag. Like if a child reacts that strongly to something in the room, something somewhere is not right. So we asked them to do some digging in their communications with the family. What we found out is that she was abused. It was at night. It was in her bed. So lights off, go lay down on the cot, was a very vulnerable position and a serious trigger for her. And as a four-year-old, she couldn't say, I'm being abused, I was abused, that this is triggering for me. So slowing down enough as adults to get curious about why might this be happening? And, you know, what do I need to do in response to that?
So let's get into some of these five things, because you went through them. But for people listening, we've got people who've been practitioners for a lot longer than I have. And we've got people who are just starting this journey, right? So there is a span of understanding. So when you say self-regulate, give the listeners an overview of what that means, so that, and people who have been doing this work are like, really, Matthew, self-regulate? Yes, because we want everybody to be on this movement and this journey of trauma informed. And we want to make sure we're all in the same understanding.
Yeah. I mean, to me, when I'm talking self-regulation, emotional regulation, it is the ability to be able to recognize your emotional state and then do something to what I call neutralize it, or, you know, bring yourself down to ground zero. So recognize where you're at, bring it back down. And that's a tough thing to do. I mean, even people who don't have chronic stress or trauma exposure, like that's a very higher level thing to recognize your state, kind of categorize where it is, and then put something in place to get back to neutral.
But yet a skill we all have to have, right?
So true.
And even I have a 10-year-old, and he gets to hear me express when I'm frustrated, because I'll say, I'm really frustrated right now, I need a minute. And it's funny, because now he'll say, I'm really frustrated right now and I need a minute. And I'm like, hey, cool. Go take a minute. I'm not going to say anything. Right. And those are the skills that we need kids to be able to develop, or say, I'm sad, or say, I'm angry. And I think coupled with that is emotional vocabulary, because having worked in an elementary school, kids can tell you happy, mad, sad, and hungry.
Yep.
That's it. That's all they have. So coupling those two are amazing. So let's get into control. When you say control, what does that mean?
Yeah. So when I'm playing detective, I'm trying to figure out which categories these behaviors fall into. Control, like a kid that's screaming for control, is a kid that is being defiant, those kids that are avoiding and escaping. To me, I'm like, okay, that probably is a control need. They're avoiding that or trying to escape that because they want to keep control. They either don't want to do something or they want to do something else. So in response to that, my thought is, okay, so if they need control, one, as adults, especially in education and parents, like most of our communication with kids is like authority, like do this, stop doing that, don't do that. Like we rarely have conversations where we actually talk to them on like the same level. So for me, it's like, I don't care how they do something or maybe where they do it or maybe when they do it, as long as it gets done. So like, I know with kids, like if it's a task or an assignment, it's like, they need to do it now. That's the time I gave them. Like, but what if we give them options for where to do it? Or how to do it, or maybe they can do something and then do it. So just coming up with choice options that are fair and motivating to them can completely give back that level of control and help them to feel empowered.
You know, all the old school people were like, what? Kids get a choice? No, I said it, do it. Right. But that's the paradigm we're trying to shift, right? Right. We're trying to shift that just because I said it means you have to do it the way I said it. And that in itself, the teenager side of me would be like, I'm not doing it that way. I'm going to do it this way. And I'm going to do it better than what you thought I could do it because you said I couldn't do it a different way. Right. And that's just my personality. And even as a professional, I still live in that space of like, wait, you think I can't do this? Watch. Right. But so many kids just need that choice. They need to feel that safety of having a choice, right? And not feel like they're just being talked down to and controlled. So let's get to this big A word, because I think we could really talk the whole next 40 minutes about the A word, and that is attachment. Mm-hmm. And I want to give you just a tad bit of my experiences as a foster parent. And I've learned what it's like to be in a parenting role, an unhealthy attachment had been the experience. And so what do you mean when you say attachment as a need that a child would have?
Yeah, it's so what kids need to have strong bonds. It doesn't always have to be maybe like with their parents. Kids end up in foster care and they end up with amazing caretakers. So they need to have a caretaker that they have this strong bond and relationship with, that they can trust, they feel safe with. And that goes back to human biology. And like we, our brains, our bodies were developed out of tribal situations. And we had to develop bonds and attachments to the people, especially people of like power and leadership in those situations, because they kept us safe. So our bodies, our brains are created, designed, that's how they were developed to have these strong connections and relationships and dependence, somewhat dependence on other beings. When that is disrupted, when things happen that disrupt that, and there are all kinds of things that can do that, then we seek that. And a lot of times when we seek it, it's in a negative way. It's like a negative attention seeking, or you'll have the kid who is overly clingy. Like we kind of overlook that child, just like, oh, drive me crazy because they're really clingy. But that for me is alarming too. I'm like, but why are they so clingy? It's not just their personality type. I mean, that might have play a part in it, but I'm looking at kids that are like avoidant, kids that are screaming for negative attention, and kids that are overly clingy and constantly next to me. And that means that somewhere there's a chance that something is disrupted in terms of their attachment relationships.
And I know there's a lot of controversy over the other stress response of fawn, right? Mm-hmm. And that is that I have to please as a stress response, because if I please you, then I stay safe. Yep. And so, you know, I know there's people who think that's a real thing. There's people that think it's not. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, it sounds very similar to what you're saying, the kid that must be next to you. And I will tell you that it's difficult for people who have had healthy attachment their whole life to understand what unhealthy attachment feels like on the caregiver or on the educator side, as opposed to, I can't even imagine what it feels on the child side.
Right.
But it's like they're just being difficult. But that is that unhealthy attachment that if you don't understand, can really be a barrier to make a connection with a student. And I think I think it's an area as educators, we do not do enough work in. It's in, and when we're in school, when we're receiving professional development, it just is an area that I feel if educators knew more and more deeply about, we truly would shift a paradigm a lot quicker. Totally. Than even through the neuroscience. So then you get to the physical need. I think we all get that one, but go ahead and express that, because I do think it's important that you dive in a little deeper.
Yeah. And that one's hard to tell because you don't really know if a child's hungry or tired or not getting other physical needs met at home unless they say so. We can sometimes see it. But I'm usually paying attention to their body posture. There's a lot that I've been reading on alignment, like physical body alignment, and like looking at people's postures and how they sit and how they interact and how they exchange with other people. And that says a lot about a person. And so if their posture is like more mopey, or they're kind of just like hunched over, it's likely that one, they're in position too long, but two, that maybe they're tired. Maybe their water intake is too low. Maybe they are hungry. And if we put something in place to meet that, try giving them more access to water, encouraging them to drink more water or snacks, or giving them the option to go to that peace corner and just chill out for 3-5 minutes, close their eyes, regroup. We might see a huge shift in their ability to function and participate and listen.
You know, it's interesting because it's one that you think would be, for the lack of a better term, common sense, right? Yeah. If kids' basic needs aren't met, we've got the hierarchy of need in Maslow's. Mm-hmm. We know all of that. Yep. But I'm going to give you a great example. I had ABA specialist I was in a meeting with, and I gave her a scenario that happened that morning. Mm-hmm. A child was laying in the hallway. She was asked to commit to do a task. She ran out of the room, laid in the hallway, and started kicking the wall and became very escalated. Mm-hmm. And so I gave her minimal, and she's like, well, she was avoiding the task. Well, what happened was I had a conversation with this child, and she was in a hotel and she was about to get kicked out that afternoon. And she didn't know when she left school if she was going to be going to the hotel she was living in, or she was going to be going to some random person's house that she didn't know that they would be. And it's just so interesting because if our brain just goes and looks at the behavior, right, we can miss so much if we don't have a conversation in relationship with the kids.
Yeah.
And I think that that physical need is one that is overlooked so often that I think could be a great starting space for a lot of educators. And you brought something really important, water intake. You know, now during COVID, people don't think kids can't use water fountains, right? Mm-hmm. So at my school, we have every kid has a water bottle. And the teachers were so anxious, like they're going to spill them on the computers. I'm like, it's okay. Dehydration is a legit thing. And when you're trying to learn and your brain is dehydrated, it's not functioning at its highest capacity. So I love that you brought that up.
Yeah, for sure.
So we talked a little bit about it, but what do you mean by sensory? When you get into that number five of those five need areas, what does that entail?
Yeah, so I think about anything kind of related to your senses. If a child has a strong response to noise, or I remember someone telling a story about like a song that they played in the classroom and a child got really triggered by it. I'm like, pay attention to that. Like that's a sign. Why would that be? So sounds, it could be textures of things, anything related to the senses that they would have a strong response to. And that one's, again, can be kind of easy to overlook because I know like the sound of a printer was setting a child off one time and no one's like, no one could figure out why it was the printer. Like, you don't think about that. We're not paying attention to that. Our senses aren't cued into that. But even for me, as a child in a very unsafe environment growing up, like if the door opens, immediately I'm like, who's here? And I will, all my attention will shift away from, if I'm not expecting someone, they walk in the door and I hear the door, just the sound and the hearing of the door, it immediately takes my attention away from what I'm doing. Even as an adult who recognizes that I do that. So for a child's brain, it wasn't even developed. Something so simple as like a door opening, that sensory stimulation could completely pull their attention away.
And man, I just think about so many situations where kids are in schools where the educators don't have this information and they don't understand the complexities of the impacts of trauma and the neurodevelopment of kids and the involuntary reactions that they have just for the safety of themselves that could totally impact how they interact with kids every single day. And to be honest, dysregulate a kid, right? So many times we dysregulate kids in schools and we don't even realize what we're doing. And you have an approach around a four-step approach around self-regulation, correct?
Yep.
So talk to us about what that is, because you got some great approaches. I'm not going to lie. I'm very, very impressed with those five. So what are these four steps of self-regulation? I think you might have frozen.
Matthew, I think I lost you.
There you go. You're back.
Hey, sorry. I think I lost you for a second there.
Hey, you know, it's the internet is a fantastic thing. We have giant storms happening right now. So I don't know if it was on my end or your end, but hey, you're back and that's all that matters. Mm-hmm. So tell us about these four steps of self-regulation.
Yeah, for sure. So at the Behavior Hub, I wanted a framework I could follow for parents, for educators, for anyone working with kids, even for adults to use themselves, to have a very simple, straightforward way to learn to regulate your emotions, your strong feelings, your behaviors. So the first step in the framework is to categorize your emotional state. And this isn't just in terms of behaviors either and challenging kids. This is, kids need to be in the right state to learn. If their brains and their bodies aren't ready to learn information, they need to do something to put themselves in the right state to be able to take in information. So usually I will, for older kids, I'll introduce the hand signal and do the barking dog, wise owl. So is your dog barking? Is your owl present? We need your owl to be present for you to learn to be calm. And then we talk about ways to get there. For younger kids, primary, I will do a chart similar to zones of regulation. It doesn't matter necessarily what each zone is represented by, but that there are four zones. So the first one being that low energy. So you're maybe tired, you're sick, you're sad. If you're on the extreme of that, you might be like disassociative. You might be lack of affect. The next one is like, you might call it like the green zone, ready to go. You're optimal functioning, you're focused, you're happy. Then you've got that next zone, which is you're losing control. You might be worried, you may be too excited. And then the last one is the complete loss of control. And if us as adults, as kids, if we can all categorize ourselves into one of those four zones throughout the day, and no zones are bad zones. It's not like I go through all of those zones throughout the day. I wake up, I'm groggy, I'm in the blue. I get myself into green. I go out to work, I get stuck in traffic, maybe not anymore, but stuck in traffic, I get into the yellow zone, I bring myself back to green. Something comes through my email, I go into red, I get myself back to green. So it's all about, you know, what do you need to do to get back to that optimal zone? So the first step is just teaching people to recognize their emotional state. If you can recognize your emotional state, you can get it back to neutral. A lot of time spent there. Once that groundwork is set, then we go into the next phase, which is not every child will need this, but some will, is creating a space in the home, in the classroom that everybody can use or the child can use or, you know, whoever needs it. But you can call it a Zen zone, a safe space, a peace corner. But as adults, it's easier for us to say, I'm feeling frustrated. I'm feeling angry. I need a minute. I need to take a walk. Kids don't always have the capacity neurobiologically to do that. So if we give them a defined space to go and take a break, and this is not a timeout, it's not a punishment, it's not a consequence. It is a preventative strategy to use, to go to pull yourself out of the energy of the situation, chill out, check in with yourself. Once you're back to green, back to neutral, come back to the group. The third step is we have to teach them tools for how to get back to zero. I mean, even as adults, I see a lot of adults not having this toolbox of tools. So that's where we really embed food and movement and exercise and kind of all of these mind-body techniques where we work on both preventative things and reactive things. So things to use in the moment and things to slow down processing and thinking that kids can use either on the spot or in that calm down space or on the go, but a huge toolbox of tools and kind of regulated around what might work well for them. Because some kids need things that like resistance work that really like give a lot of big body input. And some kids need more slow moving things like breathing and mindfulness. So we create a great toolbox for them to pull tools from. And then the final step, the one that most will overlook, because they're like, okay, kid recognized their emotional state. They use the calm space. They got to neutral. Let's move on. But the problem with that is if we don't teach them what to do differently next time or how to respond to that situation when they are calm, they're just going to do it again. And we're just going to keep going back through that cycle. So we want that cycle to stop. So the last step of the program is I have this very brief problem-solving conversation with them. Super simple. We keep it super short. It's I or they felt. So you say how you thought they felt. I felt. You say how you felt because you want to teach empathy. And then problem, come up with solutions together. And sometimes this will be hard for kids to do. They think they're in trouble. These conversations are foreign to them. But if I hide it in a game, like especially for primary school, like if we're like a back and forth, like even like don't break the ice or something, back and forth, we problem solve while we're taking turns, I can get 3 to 5 solutions to the problem in no time. And I just keep that solution list, put it somewhere where I'll see it. Right before that transition to that activity next time or whatever caused that breakdown, I remind them, hey, remember, we're going to try this time when that thing happens. So
it's awesome. And, you know, we do something based in restorative practices that I call collaborative problem solving, mm-hmm. which is very similar to what you just said in that, you know, so many times we think that if we give the kid a punishment and even suspend the child, that that's going to change anything.
Right.
And again, a paradigm, everybody's on a different journey. We've fully eliminated exclusionary practices at my school because we now understand that isn't best practice.
Right.
What you just described is best practice, right? Imagine as professionals, we make a mistake and people just get rid of us immediately.
Yeah.
That's not how we prepare. That's not how teachers are prepared. It's not as administrator how I operate. And I think it's so powerful that this paradigm has to shift in education.
Yes.
Punishment versus discipline and consequences. They're completely different things. And for example, if a child tears something off of the wall when they're dysregulated at my school, the consequence is you just put it back.
Right.
If you destroyed it, then you recreate it. And yes, right. It takes a lot of time. But that's how you fix it. And then we talk about what to do instead. So I love these four areas. And I think it's so powerful what you said about the tools, because we actually have boxes with weighted things in them that we know the kids that need that sensory input. We'll say when they start becoming dysregulated, hey, will you take that to so-and-so's room for me? I would really appreciate your help. And that's easy. I literally, one teacher had a box of bricks, and I'm not joking you. And the little guy would carry the box of bricks. And by the time he got done, he had that sensory input where he needed it, and he was good to go.
Yeah.
But it takes a lot of practice, and it takes a lot of understanding the mm-hmm. needs of your kids that go back to those five areas that you just said. Yeah. Such powerful work. So another big piece that I think that listeners need to think about is the room design, right? Because that's huge. And let's be honest, you and I talked beforehand, that had to be thrown out during COVID, because let's be honest, room design during COVID is not social and emotional healthy. It's not trauma informed, and it certainly isn't conducive to productive relationships. So let's talk post COVID, because we right now it's just a wash. We just can't, right? Yep. So let's talk post COVID or even pre COVID.
Yeah. I think and even like considering it now, like if kids are virtual or even adults, like you can put these room designs in place in your own settings. If the room structure, you can't change a whole lot, like there are still little things that you possibly can change or change your own setting. Like I'm working more virtually, so I'm changing the things in my own workspace to be more conducive for learning. So I go into like 6 different areas of room design, but just to talk about a few, I mean, think about like visual stimulation. Education is notorious, especially primary school and some intermediate schools, having bright colors and lots of posters and lots of stimulation all over the room, all over the wall. And it's actually really detrimental to your memory system and your storage system and your stress response system, because your brain has the ability to take in, I think, 50 bits of information at a time at any one moment. We're exposed to like, I don't know, like 11 million or something. It's a ridiculous number. But I mean, even when I look around my space, I'm like, okay, yeah, they're like plants and there's this, all these bits of information. When I add posters and colors and things and charts, my brain, when I walk into that room or I'm sitting in that room, has to some level take in all of that. And when I'm taking in all of that, I have a hard time focusing on what's in front of me. And the same with like video games and stuff, like about all that stimulation, that all that movement, all that color. And your brain isn't made to handle all of that or to dissect and take it all in. So if we can reduce the amount of stuff on the walls and use more whites, more white space, use more earth tones. Because again, to go back to our human biology, what we were safe in were those environments of like earth tones and natures and browns and greens and grays and stones. When things of red and oranges came into our sight, those usually weren't good things. They usually triggered our stress response because it was a food you shouldn't eat or an animal that was, you know, poisonous. So more reds, more oranges are more likely to activate kids and stress them out a bit more. So just being mindful of colors, decor, temperature is a big one. I know we don't have complete control over that if we don't have control of our thermostats, but 68 to 73 degrees Fahrenheit is ideal temperature for like brain optimization. So if it's really hot, can you bring in fans to circulate air? If blowing fans over a water source or over ice cubes will cool down a room, you know, if it's too cold, are there ways to get heat to travel around the room? Can you get kids moving so their body temperatures will come up? And I think too, just thinking about your room setup and your design. So kids aren't moving enough. We're sitting in this 90, 90, 90 position all the time. And it's not good for your posture. And if your posture is not good, your brain's not functioning optimally because your blood's not flowing as well as it should. So can we change the way kids sit, where they do their work? For me, when I taught in the classroom, I would intentionally put things that kids needed all over the room. So when they were in their chair and they had to get something, they had to go the entire way across the room to get it and then come back to their seat and they wanted something else. It was way over there versus right now we're in the, you know, most classrooms, we will put everything together. So it's all really close together so that kids don't have to move around too much, but we're doing ourselves more harm than help.
Well, and something to consider too, especially for the administrators, if your school district got ESSER funds or the COVID relief funds, flexible seating is an amazing way that you can spend some of those funds. That we are doing that. We're spending a ton of money to get flexible seating in every classroom. Now, one of my classrooms at school, a fourth grade classroom, is remarkable. There are donut seats, there are rocking seats, there are yoga ball seats. Kids get to choose whatever they feel the most comfortable. And traditionally, this cohort of students struggled in a lot of ways. And we have seen such a major decrease because they're able to bounce if they need to. They're able to roll. They're able to rock. And those are really important pieces of activating what you said, the glucose and the oxygen to your brain in order to get the functioning of your body to actually be able to learn, right? We're not supposed to just sit in one place all of the time and learn. That's not how we were developed as humans. So I love that. And for those that you who are in fortunate spaces like mine, where the district actually gives you the money, think about these different pieces that Lauren just spoke about and how could you enhance the areas of your school? Because at the end of the day, this is easily connected to the social and emotional health and development of all kids for sure. So thank you for sharing those areas. And I think that room design is key, right? Even in our little Edutopia video, one of the things that resonated with a lot of people, we don't do the fluorescent lights. We do covers over lights. We do lamps. We do all of those because it's like, my quote was, it's like laser beams. I mean, it's so stinking bright. It's awful.
Yeah. Yes.
Even thinking about lighting.
Yeah, totally. And if we can use more natural, I mean, if people don't have windows, like move kids to a part of the school for at least part of the lesson where they have the natural light, and the natural light will be reduced, like serotonin will, all awesome chemicals that like help calm bodies, but also make them more alert versus if we're in these darker spaces and you get the melatonin and drowsy, tired people and kids. It's so many parts of the room that need to be considered.
Well, and my veteran educators will appreciate this one because I know many, many use it. But if your room is really hot and you need the air conditioner, you just put a lamp in front of the thermostat and it will drop your thermostat really quickly. So that is a strategy that we have learned, that when our rooms get hot, we just put a little lamp right by the thermostat because then it automatically kicks the air conditioner on, right? We have to do what's best for kids. So Lauren, tell us about your organization, your company that you have that supports, because and also tell us if people want to get in touch with you, tell us about your social media and your website and all that great stuff.
Cool. I'd love to. So my approach is very individualized. It's the first step I recommend anyone take is get onto our website and like contact me that way, because it will come to me and I will schedule a discovery call with you. And then from that discovery call, I'll take you on a journey. What's the best for you? Is it individualized coaching? Is it group workshop training? Is it our online courses? Or is it a combination of all of them? But the discovery call will lead you in the right direction based on your needs. So that's the first step. But I highly encourage anyone to check out the website, because there's a blog on there. Yesterday, we released our podcast. We've got a podcast live now. There's social media at the Behavior Hub. And then we have a free public group raising and educating respectful children. So any of those sources would come directly to me and be access to all this information.
Awesome. And I noticed you had that new podcast, so I will be listening for sure. Because not only am I a podcaster, I also am a podcast listener. So I cannot wait to hear some of those episodes. So ultimately, the last thing that I ask every guest is, what do you want educators to know right now? What would you like to say? Hey, listen, this is what I want you to know. Because
how many things I could share.
Hey, take all the time you need. I'm a mute.
Oh, man. I think I would love people to get curious. Get curious about themselves and why they're responding a certain way. Get curious about things that are triggering them. Get curious about why kids are behaving a certain way. But in everything that's causing you stress, I'm going to ask you to get curious. What's the bigger, deeper root cause there for you, for kids, for everyone? And keep that in the forefront of your mind as you go through your day.
I love that, because in all that can be, the only person we can actually control is ourselves, right? And so I think getting curious on why did that make me mad today with that student, or why did I react the way that I reacted, or why did I feel that emotion that I felt, is such a powerful reflective tool that I hope all educators will take that advice. So thank you for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it. Please follow Lauren's work on at the Behavior Hub, as well as through this new podcast and through the blog and all of the other avenues that she is available. And I want to remind you, if you want to follow me, I am Principalist on Instagram. I am on Facebook as Matthew Portell. I'm also a Principalist at Twitter. And then I just joined Clubhouse on iTunes. I don't even have an iPhone. I have to use my child's device in order to get it. But I absolutely enjoyed my first experience. It was super awesome. It's just like a big room where everybody just talks, and you know, we all love to talk. So, but also just a reminder that registration is open for the Trauma Informed Educators Network conference that is July 19th through the 21st. It is a virtual conference this year, and we are super excited to announce our first partner for the conference, which is Stop It Solutions. Schools have trusted Stop It Solutions to protect the physical, social, and emotional safety and well-being of their students and employees and families by equipping them with an awesome technology called Safeguard Technology and Education. They actually link students with caring adults to prevent the preventable and uncover the unseen, to intervene in the imminent and earliest possible point. It is an app that is a reporting app where students can self-report, or other students can report on behalf of other students or families, and families can self-report. It is an amazing tool that removes the stigma and worry about if somebody finds out I'm feeling this way or if our family is struggling. This is an amazing tool, and we are so glad to be partnering with them on this year's conference. So thank you all for listening. Thank you, Lauren, for being the guest. Again, if you want to get registered, you can go to paradigmshifteducation.com and click Trauma Informed Educators Network. And then right there, you'll see the Enacting Equity Conference. Jump in there and join us. And as always, please, please, please wear a mask and wash